want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife. And his interests are divided. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. With these words, St. Paul gives each of us a radical call to holiness. Now, I say that in whatever state you are, whether monastic or married. But did you hear what he said? He said, the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife. His interests are divided. Now, how can this be a call to married holiness? But I'll take that one step further. It is inspiration for married holiness. In fact, monasticism is a model for marriage. That is, true Christian marriage. They derive from the same source. Paul says, I say this to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. Now let's first look at the original context, then how it applies to us today. And so stay with me, because we'll see that what it does not mean in our context, so it's not misunderstood, and we'll also conclude with how this points to the elevation of marriage. So we're going to look at monasticism, a misunderstanding, and then marriage. Now, this lectionary reading that we have for today is a short selection from a much longer passage, 1 Corinthians 7. And early in the chapter, Paul says, to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain single as I do. Now, Paul was probably a widower because all respectable Jewish men got married. But for him to tell all men, remain as I am, was a radical change. Christianity made monasticism an ideal. For the same reasons that monasticism became possible, Christian marriage became possible, which is not the same as marriage before. Christian marriage now has a monastic flavor. But it begs the question, if this is true, then why does Paul say the married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided? First of all, this is one of Paul's first letters, and they would not yet have had the more Christian understanding of marriage that he developed about 10 years later when he was writing to the Ephesians. In Judaism, marriage was primarily a means of procreation and securing your legacy, because the eternal perspective of our faith was not as clear. And they didn't have marriage as an analogy of the marriage of Christ in the church. That had not been yet put forward even by Paul. And as a result, the Jewish recipients of Paul's letter came from a context where polygamy wasn't forbidden and divorce was easy. Second, the original context is what Paul calls the impending distress. Listen to this quote from earlier in the chapter. I think that in view of the impending distress, it is well for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek marriage. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. I mean, brethren, the appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, for the form of this world is passing away. Now, what does that mean? There is already persecution, but he's warning of an impending distress, meaning that it would get worse. And he was referring almost certainly to the coming destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD. A massacre of the Jews. And the audience that he was speaking to would be both Christians and Jews. And until then, there's not only this, but Jews also persecuting those fellow Jews who became Christians. But by being Christians, they were essentially choosing the impending distress, not giving in to the Roman gods, and insisting that this is the completion of their Jewish faith by putting Christ above all comfort or worldly acclamation. And this includes Paul saying later on, I beat up my body and bring it into subjection. And so in this context, having a spouse may indeed be a distraction. But through most of history, we did not face this kind of persecution, no longer under this impending distress. So the question is, well, do these words still apply to us today? Well, in a word, yes. You might expect me to say no, but I'm going to say yes. How? By choosing the impending distress. That is, by choosing to wage war with a world that draws us away from God. So in Paul's day, Christians faced a red martyrdom. But when that persecution ended, the highest calling is to choose what is often referred to as a white martyrdom. That means dying to yourself and to the world. And if you want to do that, the best way to do that is to remain as Paul is. That remains the highest calling. The Desert Fathers pioneered what this would look like, and methods were passed down by elders to their disciples. Living in absolute simplicity, or ideally in a desolate place, obedience to a rule of life, fasting to the extent that you are able, all-night prayer vigils, praying without ceasing, literally. And for men, this usually includes sleeping on the floor or on boards, living either as a hermit or with a community of others struggling in the same way. This is the most direct route to holiness if you're free to do this. And in this context, choosing this impending distress, a spouse could be what St. Paul calls in another translation, a distraction. But that's part of the monastic white martyrdom of waging war with the world. And virtually all the early church fathers affirm that monasticism remains the highest calling. That's monasticism, but then there's also misinterpretation about this passage. A misreading of this passage is that celibacy alone somehow opens the door to holiness. A misreading is that getting married somehow closes the door to the level of holiness that a celibate person could reach. So let me be clear. Paul is not merely advocating celibacy because all that means is not being married. No, he's advocating what we would now call a monastic celibacy, a no-holds-barred spiritual struggle where detachment from this world, knowing Christ and making him known, is the only aim. That is the highest calling. But a person can be single, that is celibate, and merely a bachelor. And even if one is chaste, that doesn't necessarily get one very far towards holiness. A lot of bachelors, even chaste ones, are self-absorbed and rigid in their ways because, more than most married people, they have more opportunities to do what they want when they want. And this is even true for some priests and religious. And that's certainly not what Paul was advocating in a time of red martyrdom and persecution. And that's not what St. Anthony of Egypt was about when he pioneered white martyrdom in the desert. That's not what St. Benedict was about when he developed a much more moderate rule for living in community. Christian marriage, with Christ as the primary goal, is more on par with the Benedictine way of life. It may not be white martyrdom exactly, but it can eventually lead to that. although it may take more time than it would for someone who is free to delve completely into a life of asceticism. So it's monasticism and misunderstanding about what that means. And now let's begin to look at Christian marriage. And I'm still going to deal with some misunderstandings that before we go into a full example of what Christian marriage should look like. So what St. John Chrysostom essentially says, and the other fathers, is that Christian marriage is close on the heels of monasticism. The difference is only that you have a spouse. But the charge is the same. If there's no longer the present distress of red martyrdom, then the marriage can help you along the path to white martyrdom, even if it's not quite as direct as it would be for a monk. Marriage still has a monastic flavor, yes, because it derived from the same source. So Paul's passage tells us that your call is to wage war with the world with all means at your disposal. And your spouse, if you're married, is given to help you to that end. So it's like this. Monasticism flings open the doors to holiness, and Christian marriage does the same thing. Only the doors aren't quite as wide as for a monk who's committed to this ascesis, the spiritual struggle. So, yeah, you're not quite as free as if you're married for all-night vigils and fasts and putting your life on the line. And your spiritual guide must take your spouse into account before assigning asceticism. But you have other means. You died yourself for your spouse, and your spouse gives you someone else to guide you in the path to holiness. Christian marriage still has a monastic flavor because they derive from the same source. St. Athanasius the Great was a vigorous promoter and defender of both monasticism and the Christian conception of marriage. He called them together a twofold grace, the same grace expressed in two ways. It's impossible to do away with one, he says, without doing away with the other. The problem is that some people get married but don't follow this call because both of them bring a bachelor mentality into marriage. Lust before marriage doesn't just morph because you get married. It just makes acting on your lust a lot easier. Marriage gets a bad rap when compared to monastic celibacy because often you have two people with a bachelor or bachelorette mentality living together. And no wonder they're at loggerheads with each other. No wonder it doesn't seem wholly compared to the monastic life. It may be a sacramentally valid marriage, but it doesn't reflect the analogy of Christ and his church the way Paul tells us to in his letter to the Ephesians. Even if the couple goes to church together, that's not enough to make a true Christian model of marriage. I mean, you can go one step further and say the rosary together and embrace Catholic culture, but if you're essentially living for yourself and not for your spouse and for others, then you only have a veneer of faithfulness. And that's not the Christian call to marriage. So let me just give you an analogy of a car, then a couple of real-life examples of Christian marriage. You can compare monasticism to driving a Porsche 911 on the way to holiness. Now, some people, misunderstanding Paul's words, think that marriage weighs down the car to holiness, as if everyone starts with a Porsche. But no one starts with a Porsche. As a bachelor, you have an old 5400 at best. But true Christian marriage puts you in a Porsche. Just the trim line may not be quite as high as for a monk. But when you see a Porsche 911 on the road, you don't always pay attention to the trim line. They both turn heads. So now let me give you a couple of examples of Christian marriage from Father Josiah Trenum, a patristic scholar. Now, husbands and wives help one another to holiness. Paul says, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. That's from Ephesians. Lay down your life, Paul says, and inspire her to holiness. Now, how does this compare to the words, St. Paul's words to the Corinthians, that his interests are divided? Again, that was written before Paul wrote his letter to the Ephesians. And so, writing about 100 years after Paul, Tertullian wrote a letter to his wife in the event that he should die before her. First, he tells her to choose celibacy for Christ rather than remarry, because that's the highest calling. But then he reflects on what they have now together in marriage. Okay. How beautiful, then, the marriage of two Christians, two who are one in hope, one in desire, one in the way of life they follow, one in the religion they practice. That sound like divided interests? They are brother and sister, both servants of the same master. Nothing divides them, either in flesh or in spirit. They are, in very truth, two in one flesh, and there is but one flesh. There is also but one spirit. They pray together, they worship together, they fast together, instructing one another, encouraging one another, strengthening one another. Together they are found in the church as of God at his banquet. Side by side, they face difficulties and persecutions, share their consolations. They have no secrets from one another. They never shun each other's company. They never bring sorrow to each other's hearts. They visit the sick together, and they allow each other to serve the poor and give alms. Psalms and hymns they sing to one another, and they challenge one another to see which shall chant better to the Lord. Hearing and seeing this, Christ rejoices. To such as these, he gives his peace. Where there are two together, there also he is present, and where he is, the evil one is not. Now, that is Christian marriage, marriage that models the undivided heart of monasticism. So married couples are not second-class citizens in the call to holiness. Rather, they have marriage gives them grace to move beyond the bachelor life, to live self-sacrificial lives. Now, let's examine just one more example, this statement, to how this reflects on Paul's statement that the married man's interests are divided. Is that really normative for marriage? St. James the Persian was an influential official in the Persian court in 438 AD. He succeeded in keeping his faith in this pagan land that was hostile to Christianity. And it helped that he was friends with the king. But when the king died and his son took over, his position was not so secure. So he did the unthinkable. He attended the worship of a pagan god. But then his wife and his son wrote him a letter, and this is what she said. We have heard that the favor of a terrestrial king and the love of perishable resources of this century have made you abandon the eternal God. And we will have nothing to do with you anymore because you abandon God. We want to have nothing in common with an apostate. It's over. We no longer exist for you. Moved by this appeal, by the way, what was his wife doing? Saying, look, you must value your eternal spouse more than your earthly spouse. Moved by this appeal, St. James prayed loudly to Christ in the hearing of soldiers, who then reported him to the Shah. Despite the Shah's urging, St. James would not recant. He then endured one of the most prolonged martyrdoms recorded in history, praising God and proclaiming Christ throughout. So let's consider that statement of Paul again. The married man is anxious about worldly affairs, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. In the end, did he want to please his wife? Yes. Did this result in his interests being divided? No, the opposite, because this was a truly Christian marriage, and she urged him to have an undivided heart. She urged him to put the eternal wedding feast first. So what are you called to? Let's first acknowledge that one call covers all. Paul, again, in Ephesians, "Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." That's the call of all Christians in whatever state you are. And if you already have a spouse, then it's clear, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, "To the married I give you charge, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband. And are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free." But what if you lose a spouse? What if you're not married yet? "So that he who marries is betrothed does well, but he who refrains from marriage will do better." But then in a slightly different context, Paul uses an analogy for marriage. "Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him and in which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches." So if you are called to marriage and you pursue monasticism, then you do not do well. St. Paisios of Mount Athos, I give advice to someone who doubted his call to monasticism, and this story is recounted by monks who wrote his biography. A young man was inspired to pursue the monastic life because he thought that was the best way, but now felt a persistent call to marriage. He was a sincere person and didn't want second best, and so he sought the elder for advice. And here's what he said. He said, "A woodworker chooses the best wood, and an iron worker chooses the best iron. If you are made of wood, then don't give yourself to the iron worker, as you'll be burned up in his furnace." The message was clear. Let your wood be formed for its intended purpose, for in that it will most glorify God. So if you are single, then you have three options. Be on the road to one or the other state as the means to dying to yourself and living for Christ. Or a third option, at the very least, get a spiritual director. Be under obedience to the best that your circumstances allow. And dedicate your life to holiness by serving Christ and others. So if there were youth here, and I'll say this at 10 o'clock, but I'll just say this as what we can echo to youth. We need more true monastics who have a true vision for this highest of callings. The problem with the church is that we have a lot of celibate people who don't get calls Paul to holiness. But true monastics are a model for Christian marriage. Obedience to your elders or your abbot, the service to your community, your uncompromising call to Christ, that inspires marriage. So Paul's charge is to an undivided heart, and to consider what we would now call the monastic life is a universal call to holiness. He is writing in view, yes, of an impending distress and teaching the Corinthian church to give up everything for Jesus. And you and I likewise, whether monastic, married, or single, can take up that call. Use your state in life to embrace the impending distress and wage warfare with the world. Cast all hindrances aside. Die to yourself in the name of Christ.